What is going on here? What? He's got the bell. Whoa. Steamboat can't breathe.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following rustic exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 106 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson, and today I'm going to be taking a look at an episode that I've wanted to do for a very long time, but it is not on YouTube because reasons, and they can't see fit to post it to the WWE Network for... I have no idea why the stuff from 24/7 can't be posted, but it would all be sanitized anyway. This is WWF Superstars of Wrestling from November 22nd, 1986. This is a rather famous episode for its feature match of the Macho Man Randy Savage defending the Intercontinental title against Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, among other things that occur on this show. Given that it is in the November sweeps period when you get to see such feature matches, we also get a six-man with all-name guys in it. But first, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. You may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on Pro Wrestling Only a little bit later in the show. And for those of you who have subscribed to my YouTube channel, name, of course, Peter Winson, I greatly appreciate that, as I think I'm at about 950 subscribers, so I really want to continue that push to get to 1,000. That would be really nice. It feels weird asking for YouTube subscriptions, but like I said, I don't have a Patreon. I don't plan to ever have a Patreon, so it's a weird way of supporting this show by just subscribing to my YouTube channel, where I did post a penalty shot from the Saturday Night Bruins game, which ended 1-0, a rather nondescript game, just as much as a defensive struggle, you know, through the neutral zone, but that's all well and good. I mean, it did provide a nice break for me from not thinking about my WrestleMania weekend plans, which I should probably actually, you know, start finalizing things other than kind of having stuff that I can cancel, whatever. Certain that it's now 4.5 weeks away. I don't have tickets to any events except for a tailgate before the actual WrestleMania, which I don't have tickets for. And I go online and I just don't like what I'm seeing in terms of the ticket prices. And it's fine. I'll probably end up buying it. I only need one ticket. But it's just a little strange how all these obstructed views are on there. And to be honest, I really don't care that it's obstructed view. But I do mind paying close to $200 for said obstructed view. I know it's New York City, but I looked at the face value of how it was originally. And it makes me laugh how the WWE completely underpriced the tickets for WrestleMania. Because when you think about it, you know, secondary markets are really kind of true indications of how the tickets should have been priced anyway. And I know that as a Bruins season ticket holder, I can't get face value for weeknight games. But WrestleMania in the New York area, the fact that some of those obstructed view seats, I think, were $35 startup, which, by the way, is what I paid to get into WrestleMania 14. So you say, oh, $35. Well, you could have charged probably $75 for that easily. I mean, any time in the pre-network world, if you could go to a pay-per-view for the same price as actually ordering the pay-per-view, it feels like the smart thing to do. But that's just something for me to work out. I mean, I was more concerned about keeping the melting water out of my garage, although with the snow earlier in the week that is actually coming down as I record this, peek behind the curtain and all that. It's like I had to deal with melting on two fronts before that snow came. One, it's coming into my garage because of the way the when I had my driveway redone, I don't know, they screwed something up or I screwed up in terms of trying to route the water, but we're trying to get a good fix in. But I'm very concerned about it ruining the impromptu rink that I've had in my backyard the last few weeks. I went out skating on Sunday. Saturday, I was out there for about 40 minutes, and I was doing like wind sprints on the good ice, but then the ice became really bad. It was so soft to the point where it would, like, break under me. And I was like, I got to stop skating or I'm going to, like, tear my ACL out here in, like, probably hilarious fashion. But that would make me sad because I probably wouldn't be able to do the show this week because I would be filled with, you know, such pain. But I'm filled with sadness because as I'm recording this, we're getting the house painted, the interior walls in the house. Not all the rooms, but a good chunk of them. And I am glad that the basement will be getting painted because it's in desperate need of something like that. But as I look around, I had to take everything off the walls and there's really not a whole lot of inspiration for me. Like there's no Say album cover. There's not any of my Bruins programs, my beloved Bill Walton autographed Celtics pennant. The only thing I have left up is my Velvet Elvis, which I'm not taking down until the last possible second, and that has a wall to itself because I don't want anything cluttering the area around it. But it shouldn't screw with the recording schedule too much on these because I guess the guy's getting here early in the morning. He's starting up in the upstairs, and I'll just come downstairs until he actually gets to this room in my usual late-night recording. It's either I'm recording at 7 in the morning or I'm recording at midnight. I really wish I could, you know, do this at a more normal hour, but that's the way the cookie crumbles. So, WWF, Superstars of Wrestling, November 22nd, 1986. This was taped in Binghamton, New York. Beautiful Binghamton, New York. Actually, I don't think I've been there since like 2004. That was a driving through situation coming back from, or actually moving back to Massachusetts from Nevada. This was taped on a Tuesday night, October 28th, 1986. Say, how the hell do you remember what date it was on the calendar? Well, see, the Mets beat the Red Sox in the 1986 World Series Game 7 the night before, which was on a Monday, because Game 7 is supposed to be on a Sunday, rain, all that. It doesn't really matter, but Binghamton, longtime minor league affiliate of the New York Mets. I don't know if that was the case in 86. I'm assuming it probably was. As I mentioned, this is the sweeps period in November, so you get big angles on these shows. And I've been watching a lot of the November TV. I've actually gotten a chance to watch. In fact, I'm watching a Ricky Steamboat-Randy Savage match right now, the November 1st, 86 show from the Boston Garden, which kind of looked familiar to me at the beginning when I put it on the award-winning WWE Network, because I also watched the primetime wrestling from November 25th, 86, which is basically all the matches from the same Garden show. Not Savage and Steamboat, but this is as it aired on the New England Sports Network, I would presume, at the time. All through the month of November, there's a lot of interesting things going on, especially with Randy Savage. I'm going to save my thoughts for him when I get to the Savage Steamboat match, which is actually the first match on the show. But there are other interesting angles to it, like including the demise or the last match of Captain Lou Albano, which took place on Wrestling Challenge. It's not often you'd see something like one of the three wise men finally calling it quits, the last of the three wise men, because Blassie had bowed out a few months before. Albano has a six-man match, and they air it on Wrestling Challenge the week before this. He had his last match as a manager in the week before that, so I guess that's something that they would have saved for this period. You have a relatively new character in the Honky Tonk Man kind of asking for a vote of confidence from the fans in kind of a one-on-one with Jesse Ventura. And we're actually going to get the results of that on this show. It was a very interesting sort of thing with how that character was brought in and just kind of a head-scratcher of things that did not turn out the way they would have wanted. We're also going to see the rebel Dick Slater on this, speaking of stuff that did not turn out the way anybody would have wanted, effectively his whole run in the company. But the revamp, and this is something that you notice on these shows as you get into the fall of 86. I've talked often in the past about the revamp of the television where championship wrestling now becomes the superstars of wrestling. Wrestling Challenge evolves out of All-Star Wrestling. That was very much needed because you could tell immediately you get better production, you get better local promos of guys in the back, you're standing there with Ken Resnick because Resnick is that guy for that period in time. It just feels like a very national product, almost like the one that you would become familiar with for the rest of the golden era. It feels very much like that show you would see for the next several years with the Superstars of Wrestling banner and the WWF banner. And I guess the Superstars of Wrestling banner is one of the reasons why they don't show those on the network, because, oh, you got to blur those out. Even though they were on 24/7, I don't quite understand what the deal is. There was definitely an improvement in the production values on TV dating to when they got onto NBC on Saturday Night's Main Event, because those shows were very different in terms of lighting and everything else that you see at the championship wrestling tapings. Once you get roll into Superstars, it's much more better lit. Even Wrestling Challenge is better lit than All-Star. Things just look better, and it's really sort of comfort food, for lack of a better term. I can watch pretty much anything from, well, let's be honest, I can watch 84 and 85, probably 83, 82. I'm just stating numbers at this point. But 86 through 92, effectively anything from when they change over in September of 86 right up through WrestleMania 8. All of that is fair game to me. You could just shout out one of them and I would probably just throw it on at any point, really. Doesn't really matter when it was. And hey, the Savage Steamboat match that I'm watching for the Boston Garden had that annoying trope at the end where Steamboat wins by count out, but he thinks he won the title. I mean, I cannot even state how much I hate that, where it's like, can we apprise babyfaces of the rules beforehand? Do we think that the crowd is that gullible? God, whenever somebody asks me, like, well, what wrestling trope do you hate? I need to just go in on that and just rant about it. The other wrestling trope that I hate is when people say that WrestleMania 31 was good, because you're completely wrong. I mean, that's like saying that skinny Jonah Hill is funnier than fat Jonah Hill. It's just scientifically proven that it is not true. And part of it might be that WrestleMania 31, the Raw crowd the night after, it was the most loathsome group of people that have ever convened in one place. Ugh, just makes me sick. So, yeah, on the six-man match that's coming up on this show, we got the odd team of Hillbilly Jim, Tito Santana, and Pedro Morales, the last two of which they teamed together quite a bit in 86. They're taking on the Dream Team, former tag team champions Brutus Beefcake and Greg Valentine, and Johnny V. I almost call him Jimmy V. No, he was too busy coaching North Carolina State. He puts on the tights for a second time in November of 86 because he was the victim of the pinfall in that Captain Lou match with him and the Bulldogs versus Johnny V in the Dream Team. As I mentioned, the Honky Tonk Man's vote of confidence results, we're going to see the Junkyard Dog in action, albeit very briefly. And also, Dino Bravo, shortly after his, well, one of his returns to WWF. This is finally entering the run that we would all know and, well, not love. I just really can't figure out a way to end that sentence, because I don't want to say hate, but Dino Bravo was not good at all. There's really nothing else I could say about it. So, without any further ado, this is episode number 106, so it's time to cue up a sports moment from the year 2006.
40 seconds left in regulation. Warriors slowly coming back. They have to move it. Empty net. Oh, my goodness. A giveaway. And Brindamore at the empty net. Oh, my goodness.
What is it about the Edmonton Oilers in the playoffs in years ending in six? You got 1986, Steve Smith knocks it into his own net in Game 7. This time, in 2006, they wait until Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Final, where they got backup goalie Ty Conklin in there, who's only in because their starting goalie, the Red Hot Dwayne Roloson, had gotten hurt earlier in the game. He flubs the puck behind the net. Carolina steals it and scores to... for the go-ahead goal with under 30 seconds left in Game 1. It was so crazy. Ty Conklin ends up getting benched for the rest of the series. They go back to UC Markkanen, who only played 7 playoff games in his entire career. He started 6 of them, and all of them were in the Stanley Cup Final. Seems like that's kind of a weird fact that you could have had that, I guess, in the old days where the only game that somebody would have started in the playoffs was in the final, but not in more recent time. That's certainly unique. And what a weird Stanley Cup final that was. 2006, the ultimate outlier season for the NHL. Carolina, since then, they may make the playoffs this year. They've made the playoffs one time since 2006. And the Edmonton Oilers, since 2006, have made the playoffs one time. In 2017. It's so crazy to look back on that. That was a weird season. There was a lot more goals and all that. And speaking of goals, one of the ones that Ricky the Dragon Steamboat has set for himself is to capture the Intercontinental title from the Macho Man Randy Savage, which is our opening match.
Hello, everyone. I've got the opportunity of a lifetime, being able to wrestle Macho Man Randy Savage for the Intercontinental Championship on national television. Millions of viewers. Mr. Savage, you can bet that I'm going to be giving you my best shot.
Well, it's good to know that Steamboat is not planning to tank the match to get a better first-round pick in the next draft. But I want to focus on the Macho Man for a second here, because the month of November 1986 for him is the greatest month that any champion ever had in WWE, WWF, basically the entire company's history. I will stack this up against anybody, especially from a TV perspective, because house shows, you just don't see all of them, and how can you possibly evaluate? Yeah, you got Flair and Steamboat, but that's the other company in 89 where you could probably pick out matches from April or March or whatever, but that's all on house shows. Here's Randy Savage in November, and this is as it aired, because of course this is taped in October. You start the month with a rematch against Billy Jack Haynes, which ends with some Danny Davis fuckery at the end, which they were fond of doing at the time. Then flip over to Wrestling Challenge in the middle of the month. He's facing Coco Beware, which ends in a count-out finish. But the bizarre thing about that match is the introductions for the two guys. Randy Savage gets the already in the ring treatment. So he's the Intercontinental Champion, and he's getting the jobber intro, which just cracked me up because he's got the music and all that sort of stuff, the pomp and circumstance. But Coco has his own music, which is Morris Day and the Times, The Bird. Great, great song. Pre-pile driver, that's what Coco used. And that was a good match as well. Later in this month, you have Saturday Night's Main Event with the odd heel versus heel match with Savage versus Jake the Snake Roberts. We're actually going to hear from Jake a little bit later in the show where he will address Randy Savage. And then you get this match with Ricky Steamboat kicking off a feud that's going to run to WrestleMania 3 and beyond. And then you got the post-match angle in this one, which I'll cover when we get there. Something I did not remember about this match, and I talked about Danny Davis fuckery going on all over the product. You get Danny and Dave Hebner arguing in the middle of the ring as the introductions are taking place. And Davis was just really all over the product, and they were laying it on thick around this time. So Steamboat's music hits, because he actually comes out second, and it's just so damn perfect. Most people remember Sirius by the Alan Parsons Project as being the intro song for the 1990s Chicago Bulls. And from North Carolina, 6'6", number 23, Michael Jordan. Or the Alan Parsons Project as being some sort of hovercraft, as described by Homer Simpson.
Grand Funk Railroad paved the way for Jefferson Airplane, which cleared the way for Jefferson Starship. The stage was now set for the Alan Parsons Project, which I believe was some sort of hovercraft.
Such a great song for Steamboat, and that's one of the dubs on the network that is just so loud and annoying. I hate it so much. So Jesse refers to how big of a match and how unusual it is to have this on TV. Little history before we get going of Savage and Steamboat, because it is one of the biggest feuds of the WWF of the 1980s. The first match that they actually had on record, because they don't come in, both of them, until 85, and Savage is in the middle of the year, Steamboat right before WrestleMania 1. Their first match is in the Wrestling Classic, which is an absolute crime that the match lasts about 3 minutes with Savage picking up the victory. Second match I find that is also on tape from December 7th, 1985 at the Boston Garden, Steamboat lost that one to Savage as well. This is before Macho Man won the Intercontinental title. Third match we see in Landover, Maryland at the Cap Center on April 20th, 86. This is where Steamboat starts to win matches by countout. And then later in the summer, you get a match in July in Toronto. Steamboat wins that one by countout as well. There are scattered house show matches around this time in September and October, I guess maybe to establish the undeniable chemistry between the two. And as they lock up, it's one of those wild lockups where they end up on the ropes and we get a clean break. They go to the test of strength move, the knuckle lock, and Steamboat maneuvers out of it. Savage then runs the ropes, and you get the classic Ricky Steamboat arm drag, and with a twist at the end. So if Tony Schiavone was here, he would be correct to call it a full arm drag and twist. Savage does get Steamboat into the corner, Irish whip across, and Steamboat goes up to the second rope and kind of leapfrogs over the Macho Man, and then when Savage goes back to get him, he goes between the legs, then hits a slam for a two count. Another arm drag by Steamboat as he's taking control early, as Jesse remarks how deep Ricky Steamboat gets into the classic arm drag that he does. Savage answers with an elbow to the top of the head and a couple of shoulder blocks. But when Savage tries it again, he gets hit with another arm drag. These guys are just beautiful poetry out there. If you're trying to show a new fan what professional wrestling is and get them to actually like it, this is probably a very good starting point, because they kind of take wrestling to a higher level than what just about anybody else from that time period could. And even since, I mean, you take these matches, and they hold up in the year 2019. At least that's just my opinion. Steamboat clearly going after the left arm, and that's because the Dragon must be reading the Observer, as Dave reporting that Savage had an arm injury. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. That was 1995, World War III. I don't know how my notes always get mixed up like that. It's probably because I'm on my third notebook, and my writing is just complete crap. Like, earlier in the match, when Steamboat did the leapfrog thing from the second rope, I had to translate my notes. I had no idea. And then I had to go back and actually watch it again to try to figure out what the hell I was saying. So Steamboat gets him into the corner, sends his face to the buckle. Savage hits his version of the classic knee drop. You always hear about Ric Flair, Harley Race, the way they would do it, and being fairly similar. Savage would just kind of do it from the standing position and go straight up and down and sort of lay it in. Up top for the double axe handle, which connects and gets a two count. And Vince and Jesse both kind of agree that he was going for it a little early in the match, although then Jesse admonishes Vince for being biased. Get another cross corner whip that Steamboat reverses, and Savage, because what's good for the goose is good for the gander, he actually jumps up to the top rope, comes back with a cross body, and it's actually rolled over, so Steamboat gets a two count out of it. Macho Man gets knees up in the corner that Steamboat runs into. The pace is so noticeable relative to anything else that you're seeing around this time. I mean, I watched a Bob Orton versus Billy Jack Haynes match from the Boston Garden on the aforementioned primetime from November 25th Boston Garden show from earlier in the month. And they're both perfectly fine workers. I really like Bob Orton, but the pace that these two guys have is just incredible for the time period. Forearm to the head by Steamboat, who does not go for the pin, and Savage is able to kind of toss the Dragon to the outside, and we get a sunset flip attempt coming back in, and he's holding on to the rope to kind of maintain his balance, Savage is, and he hits Dragon after holding onto the rope. It looked kind of awkward in that Savage kind of fell backwards after connecting with Steamboat But I think that's kind of what made it. It didn't look too crisp or whatever, but I wouldn't classify that as being a botch or anything like that. So he throws Steamboat out on the other side of the ring, but as he would often do, the Dragon skins the cat, goes for the O'Connor roll, which gets a two count, back elbow by Macho Man to regain control of this one, a reversal of an Irish whip by Steamboat, and a leapfrog, and as Savage comes across, Dave Hebner, the referee, gets in the way. See, it's Dave and not Earl, because it's pre-1988. And as this happens, it's a pretty good ref bump as the standards go, but it's like, why is Hebner walking across the ring in the middle of an Irish whip sequence? It's just a terrible job by him. I'm putting on the kayfabe hat. So he really deserved to get drilled like that. Steamboat goes up top, hits the flying body press, which is his finisher, so we get our visual pinfall. And Hebner is actually back, so he recovered pretty quick by Dave Hebner's standards. But here is Danny Davis once again making his presence felt, and he actually breaks up the count in order to check on Dave Hebner. So we're establishing that Danny Davis is now screwing Ricky Steamboat.
That's Danny Davis. Danny Davis is coming in to take the place of David Hebner. What's going on here?
It is a little weird to hear Jesse refer to the referee as David Hebner, although it's not as strange as when my friend Merrill referred to the famous pop singer as Dave Bowie. I've never heard him called Dave Bowie before or since. But anyway, knee to the back, so Savage then drags Steamboat to the outside and slams him off the guardrail, so the old Brian Pillman spot. And then Macho Man rolls into the ring and then back out to break the count because he is a very thoughtful professional wrestler. And he lays Steamboat across the guardrail with his throat right down on it. And I think you know what happens next.
He's hurt. Oh, man, what? Oh, I don't believe this. The Macho Man, now, getting down from there, from the top rope. Down, oh. Steamboat's grabbing his throat. I don't think. Looks like he's trying to swallow his tongue. Well, I believe they've counted out the Dragon.
Now, Vince is laying it on pretty good, but the way Steamboat is selling it and him being such a master at it makes this work so well. By the way, you could hear Hebner counting, and he actually counts out Steamboat as he's getting rolling back into the ring. He's like halfway into the ring, so it's kind of like the cousin of the Bam Bam Bigelow count out while entering the ring from WrestleMania 4. So then the Macho Man, realizing that he is not done here, he lays Steamboat out, and he gets the ring bell and jumps off the top rope and hits him with that as well. And Steamboat's sell on that is so memorable to me because of the way his feet kind of go up in the air. Sometimes when you suffer a serious injury or serious trauma like that, things happen with body parts that you can't quite explain. I remember Nathan Horton getting concussed in the Stanley Cup Final in 2011, and he still had his arm out like he was holding his stick, even though he wasn't anymore. It's because, you know, the rest of your body kind of responds differently to, or slower to, what's going on. And I just remember Steamboat's legs going way up in the air. Macho Man actually goes up again to the top rope to a different corner, and Hebner, the referee, kind of stands in the way and kind of shakes the ropes a little bit. A little bit of dirty pull there from David Hebner. I'm going to have to start calling him that from now on.
Get the doctor! Somebody's got to do something here! Steamboat is turning purple! He may have swallowed his tongue. That's an awful thing to say. This man is hurt. He's hurt severely.
Well, yes, Vince, it is a terrible thing to say. You know why? Because it caused me to ask myself the question, can you actually swallow your own tongue in, I don't know, it would have to be a real outlier of a situation, like, say, during a seizure or a serious trauma event? And the answer is no, it is impossible to swallow your tongue. A persistent belief, experts say, but a wrong and potentially injurious one. Swallowing the tongue is virtually impossible. In the human mouth, a small piece of tissue called the frenulum linguae, which sits behind the teeth and under the tongue, keeps the tongue in place even during a seizure. So, okay, Vince is just laying it in there. I like the work of everybody involved, even if Vince has a tendency to be a little over the top. I know, a wrestling promoter going over the top. I can't believe it. But we're going to get more from Jesse and Bruno in a second. Savage is just hanging out on the apron, drawing heat, jawing at the fans. One guy actually throws something, which is highly unusual for a WWF televised event. You don't really see, like, that NWO stuff from a decade later where they're just littering the ring. They roll Steamboat onto the stretcher at ringside, and as is the time-honored tradition in the World Wrestling Federation, they have him miss the stretcher and hit the floor, because I have to think that Vince McMahon gets his jollies off seeing injured guys miss the stretcher. Or maybe you just want to, you know, twist that one more thing to make him even more sympathetic. I think what happened was that Steamboat rolled over himself, and it's not like they tried to put him on a stretcher and just completely missed. Because he's sort of rolling over, like, you know, like a log roll, or however you want to put it. So Jesse, in kind of taking stock of everything that's going on here, I have to admit, he does live up to the phrase he's very fond of saying, because he's telling it like it is.
He just rides right off the stretcher. Look at it, right on down. Still just gasping for breath. He can't breathe. Do you know what it's like not to be able to breathe?
Well, all I could say is incompetency on the part of those paramedics there. Don't you agree?
The indignity suffered by Steamboat, still clutching his throat, on his way back now to receive medical attention. This man was hurt, and hurt severely. It shouldn't keep him down like that. He's trying to lean up to get breath. Look, you can't breathe. If you have an obstruction in your throat, you can't breathe when you're laying down.
Well, not to make light of the whole thing, McMahon, but I don't think he's going to be able to talk about it for quite a while.
This thing's so amazing from all the different perspectives. You turned Savage into this crazed supervillain who is the champion and is basically just eliminating his competition through injury. You do this to the most sympathetic babyface on the roster that you have in Ricky Steamboat, at least in terms of garnering that sympathy, unless you want to say Hogan, I guess. But honestly, I think Steamboat is better at doing it than that. Oh, hi there. If you listen to the original upload of this episode, you probably noticed a weird 3 minute and 40 second gap in the middle of the episode for no reason at all that cuts out after I'm in the middle of talking about Randy Savage and Ricky Steamboat. Well, I'm here to tell you what I actually said, which, well, isn't golden stuff, but I really felt the need to say that Ricky Steamboat and Randy Savage's feud was really, really good. I think that that was a very original thought. But no, in all seriousness, what made it so great is when you get Steamboat on the sideline, yeah, you have him talking or attempting to talk. Maybe that wasn't playing to his strengths. But on the other side, you got Randy Savage taking on all comers because the babyface locker room is indignant about what he did to Ricky Steamboat. So he's now occupied with opponents like Bruno Sammartino with the angle that we're going to see at the end of the show. Spoiler alert, I'm sorry. So you lead up to the WrestleMania 3 match with the Macho Man and Ricky Steamboat, where it was billed as a last chance for the Dragon because he had had matches with Savage all through, you know, February and into March. So when Steamboat wins the title there, what do we get as our reward out of it? We get two more months of rematches, including one in Houston. They had steel cage matches on house shows. So certainly no argument from me on anything that they did with this feud. Even getting George Steele involved. Yeah, I know he can be somewhat annoying, but the whole thing with him and Liz, and he can be kind of the, you know, hapless friend of the Dragon. Everything worked out as it should have here. And now, back to your regularly scheduled program, where I played the the music that they had, or, well, not music, the sound effect they had going into the update segments that gave Gene Okerlund a bit of a headache.
With the latest from the World Wrestling Federation, Here's Gene Okerlund.
During this time frame in 86 and 87, when they would go to this update with Gene Okerlund, they would have this weird printing press noise that was playing a little bit too loud for what you think it was. And then when they would get to Okerlund and they would show him at the desk, he always looked like a man who was nursing the world's worst hangover on that day. Now, sometimes that might have been true. And other days it might not have been, and he just had a headache from all that noise. By the way, Pete's hangover cure, try to avoid sugary alcohol drinks and try to stick to stuff like vodka rocks, bourbon on the rocks, you know, simple straight up instead of mixing like four different alcohols. That'll keep you from having your worst potential headache the next day. Make sure you hydrate and you don't just pound those drinks. I mean, after all, it is not a race. So our update segment is on Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff and his feud with Hulk Hogan. Speaking of things that did great business for the WWF that kicked off in 1986, the TV as a whole for the WWF from the time of WrestleMania 2 in early April until the Paul Orndorff turn on Hulk Hogan is fairly dull. And that is a good 3 months span of time until July when that actually happens, where nothing is really going on. You've lost a lot of familiar names, not just Jesse Ventura on commentary, since that's only All-Star Wrestling. You have Roddy Piper isn't there. So Piper's Pit has been replaced by the Flower Shop, which was a pretty good show. And it does lead to, you know, setting up that Orndorff-Hogan storyline with Adrian Adonis just kind of pushing the buttons and all that. But other than that, not a lot of memorable things happening on the weekly TV for a period of several months. So Heenan he's thumbing through the WWF magazine, the latest edition on newsstands, and reads a little bit of it and gives us his thoughts.
I can't believe this.
These are nobodies.
You know, in the December, January issue of the World Wrestling Federation magazine, talk about garbage. Bruno Sammartino. See, it's Hulk and Orndorff.
Has been.
And they're rating the champ and the challenger. Sammartino says here, Hogan has a 50-pound weight advantage. Albano makes the thing that nobody can beat Hulk Hogan. Junkyard Dog says he's going to whoop him. You know, I am so tired of reading all this garbage. You see, I am the manager of this man. Why didn't they ask me? You want to waste a bunch of time asking a bunch of people that don't know nothing. You can walk up and down the street and do that. But as far as I'm concerned, this is the man to take Hogan.
You know,
how would you compare yourself to Hogan?
I would compare Hogan as horse manure and ice cream. I'm the ice cream. I'm the cream of the top. You know something? When I look at it, I hear all of what all those people are saying all over the world about Mr. Wonderful. I'm sure glad that I don't really give a darn what people think about me as long as I get that belt.
Jeez, Heenan really liked that ice cream and horse manure analogy because he would return to that when talking about Ric Flair's real world championship belt, i.e. the NWA World Heavyweight title, and Hulk Hogan's WWF title, making the same comparison 5 years after this. But Orndorff, he's such a natural Hogan opponent, and I think what makes him appealing is that he matches up with Hogan on his, you know, strength of basically, you know, the big muscles and all that. But he also can move around the ring. He's not just some big fat guy. He's not too small where he's noticeably smaller than Hogan, which is why this thing made so much money. I mean, I think about Orndorff during this time, in my mind, it's hard to separate it from the fact that his arm is effectively shriveling up from a nerve injury or whatever it was. So you say to yourself, well, he could have taken time off and gotten that fixed. But if he takes the time off, then he's going to lose this opportunity where he probably makes the best money of his career main eventing against Hulk Hogan late 86 and early 87. So when you really think about it, to my mind, your wrestling career is going to be very limited anyway. So you might as well take advantage of the opportunity when you can. And I know with other guys, like a Dynamite Kid, I've said he should have taken time off. But in Orndorff's case, just this one specific case, because you have to take everything on a case-by-case basis, I think he made the right call just kind of gutting through it, even if it did cause permanent damage to his arm. And if anything, when you looked at his arm years later, it just reminded you, oh yeah, this guy drew a crap load of money with Hulk Hogan at the guy's peak.
The 1-0, swinging a fly ball, left field, it's deep, it's way back! The Tigers are going to the World Series! Three-run walk-off home run!
When I recall the Tigers sweeping the Oakland A's in the 2006 ALCS, my first reaction is to want to break Detroit's balls for then flopping in the World Series against the Cardinals, losing in five games. Not even a good Cardinals team, one that won 83 games in the regular season, fewest wins of any World Series winning team ever. But then I thought about it some more. And I see the 2006 Tigers as an example to emulate, a source of hope for me personally. Because just 3 years before the Tigers won that pennant and got to the World Series, they went 43-119 in the 2003 season. You had Mike Muroth losing 21 games. And I think about the 2018 Baltimore Orioles, who only lost 115 games, so they finished 4 games ahead of the 03 Tigers, and I dream, oh, could the Orioles possibly make the 2022 World Series? It's, you know, it's just a way to kind of keep hope alive. So I salute you, 2006 Tigers, and Manuel Ordóñez is one hell of an underrated player in retrospect. Just looking at his career numbers, about a 369 on base percentage over, I think, a 14-15 year career. Terrific player for the White Sox and Tigers in the 90s and into the 2000s. So for our next match, we have a guy from Boston, Al Navarro, taking on the Junkyard Dog, who gets a rare singles appearance here. Because they've realized that the JYD couldn't get around so well at this point. Even in 86, you could tell he was getting a little fat, although he may have had some family issues involving a sister who had troubles that I really don't want to get into. So in looking at the name Junkyard Dog, it goes back to his time in Mid-South where he would actually bring like a tray or a wheelbarrow full of junk to the ring with him. So that's kind of where the junkyard part comes from. But the term Junkyard Dog is to refer to an aggressive dog who is guarding a scrapyard or a junkyard. And in a scrapyard, you could see, well, if there's like copper cables or whatever. I always love those people who like rob copper from whatever. It's like, how much could you possibly get out of it? Now, they probably know more about it than me, but I just really don't get it. Like copper thieves, it just cracks me up. I don't get it. So I've been to a junkyard. I think I went to like a relative's house for Easter, and then I went to the junkyard to actually buy a spare tire, I want to say a year and a half ago. Who knows? I might have even told the story on the podcast. And they did not have a dog guarding the junkyard, although you have to like walk through this office to get out there, and then when you come back, you walk through the office, and that's how you pay for it. So I don't know. Maybe that's a Southern thing, the use of junkyard dogs. I don't know if PETA has an issue with any of that. So with the Savage Steamboat thing earlier, I talked about introducing the product to somebody and using that. And to have JYD up next is also something that may also appeal to especially a young fan, because he does the headbutt where he gets down on all fours. And that was a move that when I was 8 or 9 years old, I always enjoyed it. It always kind of made me laugh. And I just loved it. And then he hits the thump power slam right afterwards because he is not getting paid by the second, by the minute, by the hour. And he picks up the 1-2-3 there. So he gets the crowd back into it. And I mentioned this on the Place to Be podcast on the main event number 2 that I did earlier in the week. Check that out on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. Getting the crowd back into what they're watching after they've seen a major angle like how Hercules and Ted DiBiase actually had to wrestle a match on live television right after the Mega Powers exploding. Here, I'm a little bit less sure because you don't know exactly what order things were taped in. However, if you're going to crush Ricky Steamboat's larynx, or larynx, as Jesse Ventura would say, you'd probably want to have somebody like the Junkyard Dog come out and annihilate Al Navarro in 30 seconds, as he did, and then bring kids up into the ring and dance with them. Howard Finkel actually grabs one of the kids to bring him over the railing for the dance session. I don't know if I'd want to hand over my kid to Howard Finkel. I saw that he was not well recently, and I hope that he pulls through because losing an awful lot of legends, it feels like, recently. And speaking of legends, we got the living legend in the back, our intrepid reporter, Bruno Sammartino, trying to get the update on the condition of Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Now, Bruno Sammartino, as a name, is perfectly fine with me. However, in news, especially back in the day, people would change their names, especially if it was too ethnic. Hell, you even see it up to this day.
For Channel 6 News, I'm Kenny Brockelstein.
Just picture some station hiring Bruno as a field reporter. Like, no, you're not going to be Bruno Sammartino anymore. From now on, you're Bruce Samuels. So now, let's throw it to Bruce out in the field.
I cannot believe what I've just seen. Never in my entire wrestling career, I just do not believe it. Ricky Steamboat actually could not breathe. The medics behind this door here now, they actually had put a hole in it, they had put some kind of a tube for him to breathe. I've never seen anything so gruesome in my life. Right now, they're working on him, the ambulance on its way. As soon as we know anything else, we'll bring it to you too.
Wow, Bruce, you sound shook. I know Bruno Sammartino, he wouldn't feel that way. But now, thinking back to the Larry Zbyszko feud in 1980, when Bruno is kind of saying that he doesn't want to face Zbyszko because it's just not worth it for him and it would hurt him emotionally to have to do it. Bruno's kind of a sensitive New Age guy when you think about it. So to hear that kind of emotion from him as part of this angle does feel natural when you think back 6 years to that one. I mean, Bruno has such a storied history with this company going back over 20 years, so that would just really be scratching the surface. So if you want to talk more about that, you can go to ProWrestlingOnly.com, where you can explore other podcasts, match reviews, features and retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows, movies, and more. Join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums, online for over a decade, with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of over 1.684 million threads. The message board is a vibrant community, whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, like, oh, I don't know, Bruno versus Spiros Arion from 1975, take a deep dive in microscope form, talking about Bruno and his sensitive New Age ways, or discuss more general topics from wrestling past and present. Check all of that out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com. And I would be remiss if I did not mention some of the outstanding shows on the Pro Wrestling Only feed that dropped this week. Of course, we have This Week in Wrestling with Pete and Timothy going around the world of independent wrestling. And don't miss WorldCast, which is in World Class Championship Wrestling 1983 in the summertime. This is the high spot of World Class Championship Wrestling, so you don't want to miss that one. And Strong Style Story released the 50th episode of that podcast, so milestone earlier in the week.
Well, Kenny, I think the WWF is the best thing that ever happened to wrestling. Since Hulkamania, I mean, wrestling has been the biggest thing in the world. I think it's a great opportunity for many wrestlers like my brother and I to meet the best wrestlers in the world here at the WWF. 1986 has been a great year for us, and we're looking for even better things in 1987, which is the Tag Team Championship.
Hey, who wants some stale white toast with no butter? Or perhaps a plain popsicle is more your speed? That's the Rougeau brothers, who are not yet fabulous in late 1986. They're perfectly fine babyface team for another era, but as you evolve into the late 80s, they're just so incredibly bland. And not only do they never get the tag team titles, you'd think the one opportunity to kind of put them in the spotlight would be in 87 when you go to the Maple Leaf Gardens show. And March 15th, you have this tournament, the Frank Tunney Memorial Tournament, where the winning team will receive a title shot against the Hart Foundation. And it is the Killer Bees who actually win the tournament. You think, well, maybe shouldn't the Rougeaus have given more of a shot because, you know, they're Canadian and all? Like, no, the Rougeaus weren't even in the tournament. In fact, they didn't work any of the shows that day. So who knows? Maybe one of them was injured or whatever. But Jacques, as a baby face, you don't get to see any of the dickish heel character that he would later portray in the Mountie and as part of the Quebecers. But he gets a nice little impromptu. We've heard these public service announcements from Bobby Heenan, Ricky Steamboat, Tito Santana in the past on Greetings from Allentown. But now Jacques Rougeau is going to take a spin at one of those.
One thing we do want to say and we do want to mention, because it's very important to us, the Rougeau family, and everybody at the World Wrestling Federation, is please, during the holidays, don't drink and drive.
It is a fact that in the United States, we did not take drunk driving very seriously until at least the 1980s. And people would drive around actually having beers in the 70s. Where the hell do you think the term road beers came from? So, okay, so to bring it home, we're going to get a little bit of French out of the Rougeaus.
Bien, on voudrait souhaiter la bienvenue à tous nos amis qui parlent français ici avec la WWF. C'est la plus grande organisation de lutte au monde. C'est la chance unique pour mon frère et moi de devenir les champions par équipe. Alors, restez avec nous.
And Jacques, very quickly from you.
Eh bien, un bon bonsoir et des bonnes saisons estivales à tout le monde.
And no, they're not sneaking in put-downs in French like they did in the fabulous Rougeaus theme song years later. I used to be able to speak French okay because I took 3 years of it in high school. And I had thought that I didn't have to take any language in college, but I screwed up going into my freshman year at BU, and I did not realize I had to take a placement test and place out of 2 semesters of French or whatever language that I so desired. So at the beginning of my sophomore year, I had to take the placement test to see if I could place out of it. I had to get to third semester, or otherwise I would have to, you know, take a course at some point. And it had been since May of 96 that I had last taken any French courses. And here we are in September of 1998, 2.5 years later, without speaking the language or anything. And I crammed in one night, and by God, one of my greatest academic accomplishments, I was able to place into third semester French.
Superstar Billy Graham right here, out with the cacti, the scorpions, the black widow spiders, the tarantulas, the sidewinders, surviving in the desert, enduring in the desert, bad to the bone, superstar Billy Graham, back on the WWF wrestling scene, and I got to come back to hurt somebody.
Oh, crap. I forgot to vet this show for any superstar Billy Graham footage so that I wouldn't have to talk about him for at least a little while. So you know what needs to be done in continuation of what I started last week. Boy, you're moving kind of slow. You gotta keep it up now. There you go. There's just one thing that a man must do. Pack in all the flavor you need. I got you shook up on your knees. Because it's all about the dog in me. I have a freak in the morning, a freak in the evening, just like me. I need a roughneck brother that can satisfy me, just for me, if you are that kind of man. Because I'm that kind of girl. I got a freaky secret everybody sing, because we don't give a damn about a thing. Because I will be a freak until the day. Until the dawn, we can boom boom all through the night to the early morn. Come on, and I will take you around the hood on a gangsta lean. Cause we can boom boom any time of day, and that's all good for me.
Well, I don't know about you, but I feel a lot better. So let's see who is in our next match here. Oh shit, it's Dino Bravo taking on Kurt Kaufman. Oh my God, we go from superstar Billy Graham right to Dino Bravo. But luckily for me, this is dark hair Dino Bravo and not the blonde monstrosity bloated bitch that he would become. And at least Kurt Kaufman actually has a fun little backstory to him, because a fun fact, Kurt Kaufman was Mick Foley's first ever professional wrestling match. earlier in 1986, and Foley was on WWF TV around this time as well. Kaufman is introduced as being from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is where, of course, they were trained. And the match that they had was particularly terrible, Foley and Kaufman. As Foley recalled in a Facebook post from June 23rd, 2016, the 30th anniversary of it. 30 years ago today, a 220-pound Cactus Jack Foley faced Kurt Kaufman in Clarksburg, West Virginia. The Instant Mat Classic featured botch after botch by the hardcore legend, including two consecutive tries at a leapfrog spot, where both Kaufman and I believed ourselves to be the band being leapt over, which meant two consecutive spots where the two of us knocked each other silly, ramming skulls at full speed as if we were longhorn rams competing for the affection of an attractive female. Yes, it really happened. 30 years ago today, I lost the match. I think it's safe to say that no one in attendance that night at the National Guard Armory in Clarksburg, West Virginia, thought that they were witnessing any type of legend in the making. Nothing says confidence like a cliched "I'm number one" hand gesture and a pair of generic black shades. And he's referring to the picture that he posted on that. And wow, can you imagine being there for Mick Foley's first match against Kurt Kaufman? But, you know, we really don't remember Kurt Kaufman. It's just... That would be a real fun thing to be able to say. So Dino Bravo had recently come back into the company about a month, month and a half before this, under the tutelage of Luscious Johnny V, who is with him here. And what's sometimes forgotten is that old Dino had a very brief run in the WWF, late 85 and early 86, as a babyface, teaming with King Tonga, the future Haku of all people, and he kind of went out quietly, and the only times he was ever appearing on TV, mostly in that tag team with King Tonga, in fact, I don't even think he had a single singles match in the entire run, he would be on the All-Star Wrestling taping, so he would fulfill the CanCon requirement of being a Canadian wrestler on those shows. And even on this run, he's only on TV at first, but he actually challenges the Macho Man Randy Savage for the Intercontinental title in Montreal because he's always a face and always a headliner in that one particular city. So my verdict is, November of 86, Dino Bravo might be annoying residually from what you know about him later, but take him in the time frame that we're looking at as a person sitting on the couch on November 22nd, 1986, he's not that annoying. So that's about the nicest thing that I could possibly say about Dino Bravo. Jesse and Vince immediately go into how strong Bravo looks. And Jesse and Vince and some of their banter, especially Jesse with the muscle stuff, really love to needle Vince McMahon, and I think just gave him a complex.
Well, almost everybody in the WWF can bench press 500 pounds now, Jess.
You can't.
I said almost everybody.
Okay, just as long as you verify that.
That's my worst lift. What do you bench now, Jess, out of curiosity?
I don't have to do that manual labor anymore, McMahon.
I forgot you're a movie star.
I'm a movie star now.
All right.
You know, you never have asked me about my hairstyle. You know, it's the Clark Gable look.
This is why I love Jesse Ventura, and especially his pairing with Vince McMahon so much, because he wasn't afraid to give it right back to Vinnie Mac. Unlike some of the other partners that Vince had that were much more deferential, I think, Jesse just operated with no fear. And working with the owner of the company right next to you can be intimidating. I think it was Bruce Pritchard on his podcast said that, you know, you're always under the gun when you're on commentary with Vince, and it's a very difficult thing. And Jesse just did it so seemingly easily, in my opinion. The back suplex is the finishing move for Dino Bravo, and that is how he finishes this one off. So he doesn't go to the side suplex until some undetermined point later. You know, I'd look into it a little bit more, but that would require me to watch like a lot of Dino Bravo matches in a row. And as I've said many times in the past, life is too short for crappy wrestling.
And Scott Rowland hits one into deep left field. Back at the wall. A leap and a catch. Andy Chavez takes a home run away and turns it into a double play. Unbelievable.
Wow.
It's interesting in the world of sports when you have somebody who makes a terrific play, whether it's in the field, at bat, scoring a goal, laying a hit, whatever. And then that team ends up losing the game. Like the split in how that is going to be remembered just because the team lost. Like if the Mets had won that game 7 against the Cardinals, Andy Chavez would have been a Mets hero forever. Probably would have a statue outside Citi Field. Oh wait, no, probably not, because he never played for the Brooklyn Dodgers, and we all know that Citi Field is just a shrine for the Wilpons' love of the Brooklyn Dodgers. So the Mets, he robs Scott Rowland of a home run there, and then because the Cardinals end up scoring a couple runs later, they end up winning the game as Carlos Beltran strikes out with the bases loaded, looking at a big 12-6 curveball from Adam Wainwright. And unfortunately, the Cardinals go to the World Series. But it always, you know, when a team loses a game, you just kind of remove these plays from your mind. Like, well, I guess it didn't end up mattering. And that's a shame, because in a game 7 to make a play like that, it's pretty amazing. I think maybe it gets remembered the way it should. So back on Superstars here, we're going to go to actually, he's back in from the field, Bruce Samuels, the artist formerly known as Bruno Sammartino, and he's going to update us on the report.
Yeah, I'll tell you, unbelievable. I've never seen anything so gross in my life. I've heard of these things where they had to put a hole in somebody's throat for breathing purposes. I seen it with my own eyes. I couldn't believe it. Absolutely. And then it was some kind of a tube in there because he was suffocating. He absolutely could not breathe. And they had to do this to save his life.
I'm not sure why Bruno even bothered to come back to the commentary position, since he's just going to have to go back out in the field before our hour is up. So anyway, we go back to Ken Resnick, who was with Jake the Snake Roberts, who had a lot of interesting things going on in late 1986. As I mentioned, he's got that bout with the Macho Man Randy Savage on Saturday Night's Main Event later in the month. But he's also about to kick off a very odd program with Hulk Hogan. And I say odd because there was a snake pit taped in which Jake threw powder in Hulk Hogan's eyes and then hit him with the DDT on the snake pit set, which I've never actually seen before. And I've looked for it, and then I kind of lost interest in actually trying to find it. Well, apparently, this only aired in the Winnipeg and Providence, Rhode Island markets, which just strikes me as entirely random. But they always took care of Providence, Rhode Island, for whatever reason, holding those King of the Ring tournaments, including one in 87, 88, and 89. Always in Providence, Rhode Island, I think, because of the proximity to their old Cape Cod. And that's why they would always run the Cape Cod Melody Tent. The McMahons always had sort of an attachment to the area. So anyway, Jake, that little feud with Hogan gets cut off because the DDT is so popular and fans were cheering him, just as they did in the Saturday Night Main Event match against Savage. So here with Resnick, he kind of gives his philosophy.
Probably not.
Always expect the unexpected from me, because I'll always show you something a little bit different, never boring.
Say the least.
Never boring. You know, maybe I don't do the things that people want me to do. Maybe I do things that other people think that I shouldn't do. Maybe, about my challenges. You know, I challenge anyone.
Now, I may be wrong, Jake the Snake Roberts, but you have openly challenged the Macho Man Randy Savage for the Intercontinental title, and I was under the impression, at least, that there was some friendship, a mutual respect that existed between you and Savage.
I respect no man that I face in that ring, because if I respected him, then I wouldn't be able to beat the man, you know? As far as stepping into the ring with somebody, hey, it's a business, my man. It's a business. If I had the greatest idea in the world, do you think I would give it to somebody else so they could make a mint off of it? No. I step up front and take what I want. The rest, I destroy. And you know how I do it, too, don't you? It's very simple. Everybody out there knows what it is. It's very simple. D-D-T.
One difference between now and then is back in 86, there were not a lot of quote-unquote cool heels, the type that would become really commonplace in the 90s with the Outsiders and WCW being the biggest example that comes to mind. And there are a lot of them these days, and sure, I like a lot of them, especially in chaotic wrestling. You know, retro AG Anthony Green certainly comes to mind there as well. But back then, Jake the Snake, kind of the biggest example of that. And because he was such a cool heel, he was going to be limited by that because against Hulk Hogan, they were not going to allow anybody to be cheered in that spot. The philosophy was certainly very different. So he turns babyface and everything ends up being fine. But he was a rare bird for that time period. And speaking of rare birds, we go to an Outback Jack vignette, of which these kind of went on forever. He was sort of like the Glacier of his time. And here in this one, our Australian hero, which, as I've said in the past, it's actually not a bad idea to create this Australian character on the heels of Crocodile Dundee being such a success in theaters earlier in 1986. But to pick a guy who is terrible in ring and has virtually no experience, well, probably a huge reason of why that didn't work out. Also, the fact that he's just completely awkward. Here, he is just clapping with the Aborigines.
McMahon, I gotta know, doesn't this dude ever talk? I mean, I know they speak English down under.
Well, I don't know. Well, maybe next week he'll do... We'll hear something verbal from him. Let's go up to the ring.
Always hilarious when Jesse would be the 1986 version of the smart mark and put Vince on his heels by asking the important questions, like, when the hell is this guy going to talk? Well, he would talk, and there wouldn't be much to it. But up in the ring, we have a very fascinating matchup here because it is a matchup of two fake funks. On one side, you have the Rebel Dick Slater, who on more than one occasion serves as a kind of stand-in for Terry Funk, most memorably in 1989 NWA WCW at that Clash of Champions where Terry Funk was too injured to actually compete in the tag match, and there were other ones along the line. So he's kind of connected to him in that way. On the other side, you have Jimmy Jack Funk, which is a much more direct connection because he is brought in the spring of 1986 to effectively replace Terry in the tag team with Dory Funk Jr. I think there was a very brief overlap with Jimmy Jack and Terry, but I mean, it's effectively what ended up happening. So it's kind of funny that these two guys were put together for this match. Jimmy Jack and Billy Jack Haynes, who we're actually going to see up next. So there's a Jimmy Jack and a Billy Jack, and that is something that definitely would not fly today, especially considering that guys can't even have first names a lot of the time. Having two guys with Jack as their middle name, it's not really something that Vince McMahon would tolerate in the 21st century. So you got Dick Slater, who is portraying this Confederate rebel character in the Northern promotion. But let's backtrack here. He's at the top of the card in Mid-South, becomes the UWF in the middle of 1986, and he leaves right around that point. He debuts on, I think it was the July 26th episode of Championship Wrestling. And why is he coming to the WWF? Well, clearly, it's because he sees an opportunity to make way more money than he would in the Watts territory. But this rebel gimmick, the Confederate dude in the, as I said, the Northeast Territory, where you're going to be working Boston, Philadelphia, Madison Square Garden, New York, on a regular basis. This had about as much a chance as the Red Rooster, in my opinion. In 1986, the Confederate flag didn't generate as much controversy as it would later. I have a suspicion that they were trying to make like a Dukes of Hazzard character out of Dick Slater, which might have worked several years earlier when that show was very popular, but I believe it was off the air by 1986. I mean, it was airing in reruns, but the show had run its course, and this character, I don't think, had really much of a chance, especially considering the geography of where he's going to be doing most of his work. I know it is a national company, but the heart of it is in the Northeast, where the appeal of this isn't going to be quite as strong. It also wasn't too helpful that he couldn't get a feud going with anybody. He had a run-in with Dory Funk Jr. on the last episode of Championship Wrestling, which was on August 30th, earlier in the year. But Dory was out the door in short order after that, and I like to call that the Ron Bass syndrome. Even though Ron Bass was after Dick Slater, the whole thing of you come in, maybe you're not ballyhooed as much as, you know, a bigger star, but you're given a feud with somebody, and then that other guy ends up taking off, and that stalls your character out. Happened to Brutus Beefcake after he becomes the barber with Adrian Adonis, but he did eventually recover because I think they were committed to it. Cough, cough, Hulk Hogan. Slater, very interesting early in this match, he gets slammed off the top rope, Ric Flair style, about 30 seconds in, which is really strange. And then he gets slammed onto the top rope, throat first, of which Vince says, we've seen enough of that today with throat injuries. But Slater comes back with a neck breaker. And you can tell that maybe they're not into Dick Slater at all because the talk is all about Ricky Steamboat. Slater gets tossed over the top rope. He's so damn nondescript, but he gets back up and he hits an elbow to the top of Jimmy Jack Funk's head, which was actually his finisher. He would come off the top rope, just kind of do the elbow to the top of the guy's head. So kind of like a super bionic elbow, if you will. And then he measures Jimmy Jack with an elbow drop. And Vince's call at the end of the match is really weird.
Dick Slater rams the elbow, covering Jimmy Jack. He won't get...
He what?
When you think of Vince McMahon as an announcer, you immediately go to the 1, 2, 3, he got him, he got him. Oh, wait, no, he didn't. Well, here, he does the exact opposite of that and is like, oh, he's not going to get him there. And that's the actual three count. That is way funnier. So if you ever wondered, point to this match as an example of Vince doing the exact opposite. What's crazy about Slater is I thought that he was out in short order and back into one of the territories by 87, but he actually hangs around past WrestleMania 3. He was not on that card, and his last match on record is a loss to Tiger Chung Lee in late May of 1987. So he leaves right before the Duggan Iron Sheik thing. I thought that maybe he might have got caught up in that whole business where the Midnight Rockers come in and get fired, but it appears like he left right before all that went down. Now, as a tribute to Dick Slater's memorable time in the World Wrestling Federation as the Confederate Rebel character, his theme song was the tune of Dixie. So I would like to sing a little song in honor of the Rebel. Way up north in the land of giants, with southern boys, Vince has a bias. Jump away, jump away, jump away, Rebel Dick. The stars and bars he does adorn, but he gets treated like he's in porn. Jump away, jump away, jump away, Rebel Dick. Stirring tribute for the Rebel, whose run was about as successful as my singing on that one. And perhaps I'll actually write more lyrics to the song next time. So we go right into our next segment, which is Piper's Pit. Of course, it was back as of September, an angle that I covered in the first episode of Greetings from Valentine. If you want to go way the hell back in the archive, when I really didn't know what this show was going to be yet. And his guests this week are Kamala, the Wizard, and Kim Chi. The Wizard, not to be confused with the Grand Wizard, because he had been dead for 3 years. The Wizard is King Curtis Iaukea, who, quite frankly, he had his day in the sun back in the 60s and the 70s, I guess. But this is where you kind of change the channel for a little bit, because he was not good in this role. And I'm going to give it a good leaving alone with the Dungeon of Doom stuff. Kamala, he's still good. Kamala, in spite of all the people around him just being terrible, could draw incredible money with Hulk Hogan. Again, one of Hogan's best feuds that he had. But the way the Wizard was on weekly TV, with the yelling and all that other shit, it's like, shut the hell up, dude. And the way he talks is so slow.
Well, you're going to get told right now from 30,000 feet away. You're going to need some friends someday.
I'll need some friends someday. Oh, that's just very exciting. Piper asks if the moon on Kamala's stomach that was always painted on was because he ate too many moon pies. I'm glad he went with the fat joke, because I'm always afraid that Roddy is going to get racial in these situations. But now that he's a babyface, he maybe doesn't have as much leverage to do something like that. But we get a little bit more from the Wizard.
Do you know the control, that I have to keep him under. Take off his mask, Kimchi.
Okay, wait a second. Now I know why he's got a mask on. Put the damn thing back on his face there. Put it on his face. Do me a favor. Do me a favor. And all America, please don't let him breathe.
The audio getting all distorted there at the end was very apropos for this segment. Roddy kind of saves it by the force of his personality, but they're not going to bat 1,000 on this show. I mean, for God's sake. So what the hell are you expecting? I've always talked about Piper's Pit having a lower batting average than other segments. This one was not good because the Wizard is kind of terrible. If you listen, if you know one thing about me from listening to the show, I'm very deferential and I have great respect for the legends of professional wrestling, but for God's sakes, that doesn't mean I have to tolerate that shit. As for Kamala, though, I have to say, if there's one Kamala Harris, you know, Jim Harris portraying the character, if there's one Kamala Harris that I would vote for president of the United States, it would be the guy that had the feud with Hogan in 86 and 87.
Third and goal. Coming after Brady, gets it away, he's picked. He's picked in the end zone. It's Bailey. Bailey taken off, and he gets away from the one man who had a shot at him. Talk about a game changer. Bailey, is he in or not? Running it back 100 yards before Watson comes in at the last minute.
Bet you didn't think I was going to play a Tom Brady interception in a playoff game. A horrible throw by Brady. They're down 10-6. They're about to go in for a score, take the lead in Denver, a house of horrors for the Patriots for years and years, going all the way back to the AFL in the 60s. He makes the bad pass. Champ Bailey runs it back 100 yards. It looks like he's all alone. And out of the corner of the screen, you see Ben Watson come running across the field at like 300 miles an hour. And he knocks the ball loose at the 1 yard line. And it was friggin' impossible for that ball to actually go out of bounds before crossing the goal line. Just the sheer physics of it. But they rule it out of bounds at the 1 yard line and they give Denver the ball and they go in and score. Patriots weren't winning that game anyway, but that should have been a touchback. And the Patriots should have had the ball at the 20-yard line because Champ Bailey apparently can't run 100 yards without getting winded. What a great professional athlete he is. But raise your glass to Ben Watson, who retired after this past season with the New Orleans Saints. Always a favorite of mine, drafted by the Patriots in 2004. And I'll always remember the combine note about him from the Sporting News that I read at the time. That tells you how long ago it was. The Sporting News said that Ben Watson did everything but turn water into wine at the scouting combine. Now, that's a report that you're always going to remember. Of course, it was not Ben Watson. It was Jesus who turned water into wine. And Billy Jack Haynes has found Jesus, I guess, in recent years. And he's taking on Ray Vance. And there's no intros for this match. I don't know if it was just a cut in the tape that we have, but no introductions whatsoever, so you have to pull Ray Vance's name from elsewhere. I am going to plug this once again because it came out about a month ago on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, the Military Industrial Suplex, the Tom Batista interview with Billy Jack Haynes that runs about 2 hours and is just a fascinating look at a guy who is admittedly very troubled. I know that I certainly would not screw with this guy. But Tom got a lot of great stuff out of him. All you think about, oh, the Billy Jack Haynes is crazy. He makes all sorts of accusations. But this one is much more measured and something different that you're hearing from him. As I said, he's not a guy that I would trifle with, in the words of that guy from Princess Bride. He takes no prisoners, is what Jesse and Vince seem to agree on, but then they get into an argument about grammar.
Billy Jack Haynes is the kind of individual who doesn't take prisoners.
Yeah, he definitely don't. He's big enough not to.
Definitely doesn't.
What are you, my English teacher, McMahon?
No, but I don't want the youngsters of America.
Hey, just because you got some piece of paper that said you went to college and you can count to 5 on one hand, don't mean you come and criticize the greatest announcer in wrestling. The one that keeps you working.
I beg your pardon?
I'm the one that keeps you in a job.
Jesse gets all over Vince, and Bruno is there, but he's not saying anything right now, probably because I think Bruno is on Jesse's side. And in this three-man booth, what I love is when you could hear Bruno chuckle at stuff that Jesse says, where he's ripping on Vince. Like, that stuff just makes me so happy to hear, because Bruno and Jesse have a combative relationship in the booth. But really, they're on each other's side because they both don't like Vince all that much. And I don't know if you could hear. You probably could on that clip. The heckler is yelling boring at Billy Jack Haynes. It's not like they were sitting in a chin lock or anything like that. He was just kind of clubbing them with forearms. So, again, goes back to my 86 WWF crowd yelling boring. And at weird times, too, in this case. It's a minute and a half match, and they're yelling boring at Billy Jack Haynes. He was a guy who was anything but boring to me. You know, if you know the whole history now that has been laid out in many interviews. But again, I recommend that Military Industrial Suplex interview that was released about a month ago. Full Nelson, right after that boring chant ends, locks that in, and you get a submission there. So, a victory for Billy Jack Haynes.
This is Jesse the Body Ventura in the World Wrestling Federation. I'm here with the Honky Tonk Man. And Honky Tonk Man, the time is at hand. The votes have come into the World Wrestling Federation on the big issue. Do they approve of you or do they disapprove of you? And let me tell you right now, 674,383 votes were cast, Honky Tonk Man, by the World Wrestling Federation fans.
Woo, that makes me feel good. I knew they'd love me, Jesse. I knew the World Wrestling Federation people. I knew they'd vote for the Honky Tonk Man. I knew I could persuade them. I knew they'd like the way I walked.
Wait a minute. I said 674,000 votes were cast,
Honky
Tonk.
That's right.
But only 71,111 voted that they liked you, that they digged
they
you.
They did what?
603,000 people said the Honky Tonk Man, we don't dig your style.
No,
we don't like your greaseball
right.
hair.
That's not right.
Take a walk back to Podunk, Tennessee.
I don't think you got the figures right, Jesse. That can't be true.
That's the truth, man.
It
as
can't be true.
As sorry as it is, that's
I'm,
the truth.
That's it. I'm going right now to that big fat tunny, and I'm going to get to the bottom of this.
Whoa.
To put the number in perspective for the number of people that they claimed voted in this Honky Tonk Man vote of confidence is more than the number of ballots cast in the 2016 U.S. presidential election in the states of Montana, Rhode Island, Wyoming, Vermont, there's probably others, Washington, D.C., is certainly less than that. Now, they had built this up over several weeks where clearly, you knew that the Honky Tonk Man thing was not working, and he kind of gave these speeches saying, I got to find out if the people are on my side. And he's got definite delusions of grandeur, very similar to what I was claiming Jeff Jarrett had several episodes ago. I like the idea of Jack Tunney as like the election monitor, like he's the guy from the UN in the blue helmet monitoring the election, like you're going to go protest to him. It's really a delightful way to rectify an error that was made thinking, oh, we can bring in Honky Tonk Wayne from Stampede Wrestling and make him a babyface and a friend of Hulk Hogan. Just think of how much money they made with him in 1987, having him as the Intercontinental Champion, how much everybody hated him, and then you get the big payoff in 88 when the Warrior finally destroys him at SummerSlam. He was an annoying-ass heel by any standard. And to think of him as a babyface is just absolutely insane. He was perfect for the NBC audience. So to have him front and center on various Saturday Night main events or the main event in 1988 defending against Randy Savage there as well just seems natural. And also, he is the perfect protege for a guy like Jimmy Hart because Jimmy Hart at heart is, no pun intended, is a musician. He was in a band back in the day, the Gentrys, and for him to be managing this guy who was portraying this Elvis-like character, the Honky Tonk Man, just seems like a natural fit. And it's crazy to me that they didn't do that originally.
Michael Kanin, who has made a headline for missing 6 of his 8 field goal attempts this year, is now back to just punting and kicking off. The former Saint Morton Anderson is here for most field goals. Look out! Right through! It is scooped and scored by Curtis Deloach.
in New Orleans.
Pretty sure Steve Bennett would have been all over my case if I had forgotten to put in the Steve Gleason block punt. The New Orleans Saints, the first game back in the Superdome after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, basically derailed their entire season, moving them all over the country, playing a quote-unquote home game in New York, home games in San Antonio, and I think elsewhere. I think they might have played a few games at LSU, as it turned out. But they were an incredible story that year. Steve Gleason, you know now as the guy battling ALS. Earlier that year, the Saints had gotten Drew Brees in free agency because the Miami Dolphins, who looked to be landing Drew Brees, screwed up and said, you know what, we're going to pass because we feel like his shoulder is going to derail his career. Yeah, great, another great decision by the Miami Dolphins. They've just been full of them the last quarter century. The Saints ended up winning that game against the Falcons on the Monday night and ended up in the NFC Championship game that year before falling to the Chicago Bears. So for our last match on this show, we have a six-man, which has the feel of we want to get all these guys on this show. We want to showcase as many people as possible, especially on the babyface side, where you have the very odd team of Tito Santana, Pedro Morales. Now, those two guys had teamed quite a bit, but when you throw Hillbilly Jim into the mix, I don't know what to call this team. The Mexahicks? I don't know. Mexicools came later, so I think the Mexahicks. And they're taking on Johnny Valiant, Luscious Johnny V, and the Dream Team. Now, as we go into this, we had a really bad thing happen to Ricky Steamboat early in the show, and Vince is rather despondent about it. So how do we lift his spirits? He needs a pick-me-up after Steamboat getting his throat crushed with the ring bell and all that. Well, you can do it by two different ways. You can show a hot piece of ass Federette walking by and Hillbilly Jim dancing in the ring and doing cartwheel.
All right, pretty Federette there. We got a little hoe down here. Yeah, come on, Jazz, get up. Come on, get up.
Nah, I don't like this kind of music, McMahon.
I'm sure when Vince McMahon is getting it on with the administrator for the Small Business Administration that he's got two TVs going on in the background to kind of keep himself up, if you know what I mean. One of them has got just footage of Federettes walking around ringside, and the other one is just Hillbilly Jim footage over time. Those are the two things that gets his rocks off. Poontang and Hillbillies. What a weird dude he is. Jesse almost calls Greg Valentine Johnny Valentine because he remarks on the Hammer's robe that he has. I didn't really get a good look at it, so it's kind of a wasted anecdote since we never really get to judge for ourselves, because I thought he was going to say Johnny V, but then as he was talking about Valentine, it kind of made you think that he was talking about Johnny. He was going to say Johnny Valentine. They let us know that Bruno is back into the field. Bruce Samuels is back out in the field reporting, looking to get an update on the Ricky Steamboat thing. It's okay that he's gone. He doesn't really say anything anyway, although I will miss if he would have laughed at anything Jesse said, ripping on Vince. Right away, the Hammer runs into the big boot from Hillbilly Jim. You know, the big boot that was given to him by Hulk Hogan back in late 84 when they had those little training montages. And Pedro Morales is in with some left hands on the Hammer like it's 1981 and they're feuding over the Intercontinental title all over again. And he kind of shoves our referee. Yes, Danny Davis is back again. He's everywhere like shit. Yeah, he's in this match too. I kind of want to make a law or a rule. Maybe not the way. I don't want to say I'm going to make a rule because that sounds like Bill Maher. Limit. Could we have just had one Danny Davis thing per episode instead of just laying it on, you know, multiple times each episode? Could we spread out the annoyingness and only piss us off one time per show? I know it just means that he's being effective, but you can make me angry once per show instead of twice. I don't know if he took any weeks off. I'd have to look at all the episodes of TV, and that's a lot to do. So the Dream Team, they work over Morales in the corner for a bit, but then Brutus is caught with a backdrop as he runs the ropes. Tito gets in there, and he whips Valentine into Brutus, which Valentine had come into the ring illegally, I might add. and he sends Brutus into the boot of Hillbilly Jim that he has up at, while standing on the ring apron. And Beefcake is begging off, and what Danny Davis does is he lets Beefcake kind of call, he kind of gives him the timeout. If Gorilla was there, like, there's no timeouts in the world of professional wrestling, Jess. Well, apparently there is if we're operating under Danny Davis' late 1986 rules. So now the heels regain the advantage. Jim is now in peril, but when Johnny V gets in there being the manager, he gets caught. Even though he's a former tag team champion on a damn good Valiant Brothers team from the 70s, tagged to Tito, who gets it, hits Johnny V with the flying forearm, locks in the figure four. Greg Valentine jumps in the ring to make the save, drops the hammer elbow on Tito to break things up. And everything goes haywire. You get all six men in the ring. And in the middle of all this, Danny Davis just decides to call for the bell. So the thought is, okay, well, he's just throwing the match out. We're going to have a double DQ, and we'll just move forward as if this never happened. But instead, he awards the bout to the team of the Dream Team and Johnny V. And Jesse has a rather interesting take on it.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, it's obvious here that Danny Davis feels that the Santana team was the ones that caused this total melee of all six guys getting into the ring.
I don't get on Jesse very often for the way that he talks. God knows I have an accent of my own. But melee? I've never heard melee pronounced melee like that. It's just really weird and kind of disrupted my whole train of thought at the end of this segment. But I will, once again, call for limitations on usage of heel referees to one time per one-hour episode. My name is Peter Winson, and I approve this message. That song, Everybody Have Fun Tonight by Wang Chung, was number 13 on the charts for November 22nd, 1986. And the song was later used in an episode of WWF programming as kind of a music video, just kind of showcasing the various superstars of the World Wrestling Federation. So we go back to Ken Resnick in the interview area, and he's got Jimmy Hart there. And some big news were promised as a new member of the First Family. Oh, wait. Excuse me, we're not using that name because we're not in Memphis. Instead, he calls his stable the Hart Foundation, which, catchy name. Unfortunately, it's already being used by an existing team within it. But in any event, Jimmy Hart has a new member of the Hart family, I guess, for lack of a better term, and the man works fast.
You know, the phone in my office rang last week and it said, long distance information, give me Memphis, Tennessee, because I want Jimmy Hart, the mouth of the South, to manage me. And on the other end of the phone, it was the honky-tonk man himself. And baby, we signed a long-term contract, and the first thing I did as his manager is I checked into this vote of confidence situation, man. You know, I heard Jesse the Body when he said that honky-tonk man had 700,000 votes against him and about 3 votes for him. Well, I went to Jack Tunney, man, and we took care of the whole situation, man, and I looked it up, and it was all wrong, baby. He had it backwards. It was 700,000 votes for honky-tonk man at about 3 votes against
him. Now, wait a minute. Now, Jimmy Hart, I don't want to call you a liar, but
no, you're calling me
nothing. The body
man
had it all tabulated.
Baby.
It was done by an independent judging organization.
An independent judging organization. Kind of makes me think of those guys at the NBA lottery who are there to kind of show that everything here is on the up and up, where they bring in a couple dudes from Ernst & Young to kind of oversee the process. I wonder if they did this with the Honky Tonk Man, like election monitors again. Although if Tunney is the head election monitor, I can't imagine that it would have gone very well. So the Honky Tonk Man comes in from screen right. See, he is with Jimmy Hart now, but, like, boy, he gets mad at the vote of confidence thing going the wrong way, and then he turns heel literally 15 minutes later in a completely different segment. But, okay, I'll accept everything that's going on, because in Honky Tonk's promo, there's a certain familiarity of stuff that happened later with what he's saying.
Yeah, it was independent, okay? It was real independent with that big fat Jack Tunney. And when this man right here, Colonel Jimmy Hart, got a hold of the Honky Tonk Man, he said, I'm going to do two things for you. He said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this mess about this voting. I'm going to find out who started all this stuff. I'm going to find out what the vote of confidence is all about, how the people in the WWF feel about you. And he said, I'm going to take you to the top, all the way to the top, all the way to the world's championship. He said, "Honky Tonk Man, I like the way you walk. I like the way you talk." And he said, "I like to be associated with people like that." But when I come to the WWF and I tried to do that, I tried to walk and talk the way the people of the WWF wanted me to, I just didn't understand it. So I said, "I need a vote of confidence. I need somebody to stand behind me. I want all the fans behind me." And I knew, I just knew deep down inside, Ken, I knew they loved the Honky Tonk Man. I just knew they loved me.
For a little bit there, I thought the Honky Tonk Man sounded like late 95, early 96 Diesel, you know, railing against the creative direction that they had planned for him when he was the champion as the smiling jackass babyface that completely failed. And by the way, that's the first ever comparison made between Kevin Nash and the Honky Tonk Man. I'm pretty sure you're not going to get that kind of, you know, perspective anywhere else. So in case you were wondering, the three guys, Honky thinks that they got the results reversed. Okay, he's delusional again. So he said three guys voted against him. So if you're wondering who those three were, he lays it out.
That's what I said, three. And one of them was Tito Santana, one of them was a Junkyard Dog, and the one that I thought would never vote against the Honky Tonk Man, the man that asked me to come to the WWF, he begged me to come, none other than Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan voted first against the Honky Tonk Man. He said he didn't like me.
And that is a very clever way to undo something that was really hilarious in retrospect, which was in the Honky Tonk Man's early TV matches as a babyface, you get a Hulk Hogan promo endorsing the man as in an inset promo during his match, which when you think back about it, it's just crazy, but they really thought that this guy was going to be a top babyface and you're going to align him with Hulk Hogan that way. Hell, it worked with Hillbilly Jim back in the day. You pair anybody with Hulk Hogan, you figured it would work, but not the Honky Tonk Man. That is how singularly loathsome the dude was. But congratulations on the Hall of Fame, dickhead.
It was one of the most devastating things I've ever seen. No excuse in the world for it. There was no reason by this slime, the so-called champion, to have...
Well, yeah, what's the update? Tell me, man. It's in the hospital.
Are you happy about it?
It's in the hospital. To the hospital yet, huh? Did he put some mustard on him right now, get him all set up for the champion right there? I'm so proud of myself.
You piece of slime. You're happy about it?
And that is how our intrepid reporter Bruce Samuels ended up getting fired. He's doing his closing stand-up, trying to give an update on Ricky Steamboat, but he gets distracted and commits assault and battery when he gets mad at the Macho Man Randy Savage. But yeah, in all seriousness, we get Bruno Sammartino trying to give the update, and the Macho Man kind of saunters across to interrupt the whole thing, to just kind of brag about it and just be a complete dick. And what was so great about this is that it set up a series of house show matches between the Macho Man and Bruno, one of which is, I believe, on the Boston show from January of 1987. That's actually a very good show if you want to go and watch that one. He's such a dick on this. Like, he's so proud of having crippled this guy, which, when you really think about it, you put on the kayfabe hat. It was for no other reason than to just eliminate the competition. Kind of sounds like Vince stealing time slots, but that's for another time. So Bruno, he's wearing that red jacket, the WWF jacket, same one as Vince, how they always match, and Jesse is wearing whatever it is that Jesse wears, and Bruno just takes him down with his old man strength, and I just love this so goddamn much. And they brawl, and some of the baby faces around, you can see Hillbilly Jim, who just worked a match, but he's there to break up the fight as well. And holy crap, the Macho Man Randy Savage, just so damn prolific in November of 1986, taking on all comers, facing new guys like Coco, facing legends like Bruno, facing top guys like Ricky Steamboat, who are among the best that ever set foot in the ring. Oh, it's just so amazing to just focus in on this one month. And Vince and Jesse wrap it up. Jesse is indignant about Bruno attacking the Macho Man and says that he shouldn't be allowed to broadcast anymore. It's like, what is your problem? He doesn't even say anything. And if anything, he laughs at your jokes. So I don't know what the deal is, Jesse. But that is the end for both Bruce Samuels and this episode of the Superstars of Wrestling for November 22nd, 1986. I want to thank you so much for listening. And to be sure to give Greetings from Allentown a 5-star review on iTunes/Apple Music. That does provide what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this podcast. Also, give a 5-star review for the Pro Wrestling Only feed. I'd like to get that number up as well. You know, it's all search algorithm. I don't know much about it. But what I do know is that that social proof thing is real. It's not just a term that I made up. It's a term that I heard on a Baltimore Orioles podcast that I like to listen to. So in other podcasts this week, sure to listen to the Sportscasters with my pal Steve Bennett. I don't know if there is an episode coming out in the next couple of days. I do know he's going to be on Richard Deitch's podcast coming up, or at least is scheduled to at some point in the next month. So I'll keep appraised of that. On the Our Vantage Point podcast, they're episode 120, and they wrap up their Royal Rumble series, ranking, there's a lot of R's in there, the announcers through history. So they're going to have their final top 10, and I can only assume that Angelo Mosca came in at number one. And speaking of Mosca, on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and the brawler, Brian Malonis, I wanted to call him the Kingpin, but he is the brawler, Brian Malonis in ROH as one half of the Bouncers. They took a look at a Maple Leaf Wrestling show from September 22nd, 1984, where Angelo Mosca is on color commentary with Vince McMahon. And that's an episode I may well do. I kind of want to do the whole Mosca catalog of shows that he was the announcer on because I love him so damn much. And when I guess there was a women's match on that episode of Maple Leaf. And he may have said a few things that was termed by Crockett as being sexist, to which I only have one reply.
What's wrong with being sexy?
Well, you know what they say, there's a fine line between clever and stupid. All right, I should get out of here before I start quoting the entire movie. This is Spinal Tap, although it would be well-deserved, and it would be a lot of fun, but that is not what I'm here for. For next week's show, I don't have anything set in stone as of yet. I thought about maybe a King Kong Bundy tribute. I might float something like that out there. But, of course, he's been in so many different places, you know, World Class, Mid-South, Memphis, even another WWF show. There's a lot of ways that I could go with that. So stay tuned to social media. You know, again, follow me on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod is probably the easiest way. That's where I announce what the next show will be, or what I almost certainly will use. I hardly ever remember to post to Facebook because I forget that it's there. So do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Eliminating the number one contender.
Yes, but Jesse, come on, let's be serious now.
I am serious.